Good evening. Open up to Psalm chapter 11. Psalm 11, that'll be our text. We'll camp out there in Psalm 11 and listen to a message that's being conveyed there. I'm a nerd and I like polls, you know, surveys and things, getting opinions, and I find that stuff very fascinating, interesting. One of the typical polls you will see being gathered has to deal with outlook. Okay, so given the present state of conditions in the world or in the job market or whatever, what is your optimism about what's going to happen in the future? And what you find is a lot of the response is very negative. People are discouraged. So it could be asking teachers about the state of the educational system and they are discouraged about the future. Or college graduates about their likelihood of finding a job in their field. They might be discouraged. Or people looking out at the nature of the world and geopolitics and terrorism and feeling discouraged about the direction the world is going in. So collectively, we might feel this negativity, discouraged about how are things going to work out? Are they going to work out? We kind of come to the conclusion, probably not. It's just not going to end well. And we might feel that on a very personal level, thinking about where our life is in a given moment, goals that we may have set, relationships that we have, and thinking about what's going to happen in the future, and we kind of decide, based on present conditions, it's not going to end well. And we grow discouraged, and we wrestle with those difficulties, and ultimately decide to give up. The question, though, comes, what are we going to do about that? And this is where I think, fundamentally, where discouragement is such a real problem. Other issues we might have, the solution is independent. Right? So if we wrestle with anger or something like that. Overcoming anger, well, you think about, well, I shouldn't be angry, and we find some solutions to get around that. Discouragement, by its nature, tells me, well, there's nothing you can do about that. So what's the solution? Discouragement says there is no solution. And so it's very easy to give up and coast along and just accept some type of negative faith that it's a done deal. Well, this evening, I want to look at Psalm 11, because David finds himself in a position of discouragement, based on present conditions, it would look like things are not going to end well for David. And the people around him second that motion and tell him, yeah, David, it's probably not going to end well, and this is what you should do as a response to it. So we're going to look at Psalm 11 and see how David deals with his discouragement in situations like this and hopefully gather some helpful tools for us in looking at our own situation. Let's look at Psalm 11. He says in verse 1, "In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow, and they make ready their arrow upon the string to shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Upon the wicked he will rain snares. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. And the upright will behold his face." David begins dealing with his discouragement, describing this position that he's found himself in. And he finds himself in this position of deep adversity. There's debate. I don't think it matters too much. But when did David write Psalm 11? There are two historical points that get posited. Either it was he's on the run from Saul, so he's angered Saul. Saul doesn't like this young up-and-comer, and so Saul is pursuing him, trying to kill David. The other option is maybe when Absalom rises up in rebellion against David and he has to deal with that. Either way, the situation is basically the same. This person that David is close to, that has some type of relationship with, is out to kill him. And he's in this very difficult situation where his life is being attacked and his station is being attacked. And he gives some extra description of this in verse 2. "The wicked bend the bow and they make their arrow upon the string to shoot in darkness at the upright in heart." He is living this this life where it seems like it's nothing but darkness and shadows around him. And particularly his enemies rest in the shadows, where betrayal for David at any moment could creep in. He's on the run from Saul. Is one of his companions going to give him away? Is somebody going to finger David and say, well, there he is, and let Saul know? Is this going to happen with Absalom? Is somebody going to betray him? And he lives with this negativity that people are trying to aim their bows and shoot their arrows into his heart. Doesn't sound too far off from the world that we find ourselves in, where wars in the past were fought by people in uniforms, but now they're fought by people strapping bombs to themselves dressed as civilians, or as a civilian walking into a church and shooting up a congregation of people. Where at any moment that darkness just seems to aim its arrows at us and be ready to strike. And we think about it, we look out in the world and think, well, what am I going to do about that? I can't see my enemy. I can't see all the terrible things that are happening. And we might think, well, it's just best to accept that fate and to give up. So our lament may be like David's, that the foundations are being destroyed. God's righteousness or his justice seems so far away. Foundations are destroyed. My life is in shambles. It's crumbling. And all that's out is to see my life destroyed. And what's made worse for David is it's nurtured by poor advice. There in verse 1, he apparently has people telling him, you know what, David, you need to just get out of here. Just run. And that when we find ourselves in discouragement, that type of advice sounds really good. The type of advice that says, think about yourself first. Do what's best for you. And so for David, that would be just get out of here. Leave the throne behind. Leave the kingdom behind. Save your life and get out of here. Flee to the mountains. Look out for yourself above all. I've been guilty of giving that advice to people, of telling them to think about themselves and what's best for them in a situation, not to be so much concerned about other people's thoughts or feelings or their devotion to God, but to think about themselves and protect themselves in a difficult situation. But that doesn't seem to be the biblical view. It's certainly not how David reacts to it. He doesn't seem content with that advice, just to run away. Or even thinking about Jesus and dealing with his disciples. Constantly the disciples are telling Jesus, think about yourself, Jesus. So they say, don't go to Jerusalem. That's bad news. Just don't go. Or they try and take the life of people coming to arrest him because they're telling Jesus, think about yourself first. But Jesus refuses that type of mindset or refuses that type of advice because there are bigger commitments at play than simply what is best for Jesus in the moment. David reacts to the people giving him advice the same way. The question gets left unanswered there in verse 3, but I think the answer is implied. What is the righteous to do when the foundation crumbles? Rebuild it. Not to throw your hands up and walk away, but to do something about it. And that's what David determines to do. He then makes a declaration, or starts it in verse 1. He says, in the Lord I take refuge. And he declares his dependence upon God. Implied in that, for him to say he needs refuge in God, is that he's in need of safety. Or just simply, he's in need. He's not able to do this by himself, nor does he have any pretensions of doing it by himself. He understands his need for God as refuge. Also notice in there that it's not a prayer. There's no prayer or petition to God in the psalm. He doesn't say, God, please be my refuge, or God, please do X, Y, and Z. It's more he declares, God is my refuge, and then we'll describe God and who he is and what he's doing in 4 through 7 that we'll look at in a moment. But he determines, this is who God is and how I will enter into this relationship or how I will deal with my difficulty based upon this declaration. I do not take that to mean, though, that David has, because he can say in verse 1, the Lord is my refuge, that he has removed from his mind any doubt or fear. That he's somehow has this notion of God that, well, he has zero questions left. He has no more doubts or questions about how things are going to work out, or is it going to work out quite like he expects? If you look down, these were not written chronologically, most likely, but you get a sense of that in Psalm 13, where David's position there is not, okay, God will take care of all this, everything's going to be great, it's all working out. His psalm there is anything ever going to happen? Is God ever going to deliver? Is God ever going to vindicate? And so David's saying in Psalm 11, in the Lord I take refuge, I do not take to mean, well, I have no questions anymore. Everything's going to be great. God will take care of all this, and I'm just going to sit back on easy street. I think it's perfectly coherent and likely that David can make that affirmation in Psalm 11. Say, God is my refuge, all the while wondering and questioning and fearing what the next step is going to be. I think those fit together just fine. What I think that indicates for us, though, is sure, maybe David doesn't know how things are going to end or what steps it's going to take to get there and how much pain and heartache or how long it's going to take. But he has those questions and he wrestles with those fears from the standpoint of God being his refuge. He starts with God and then addresses the questions and fears and doubts, all the while having his faith and his confidence in God and what he's doing. We'll talk more about that in a moment. He then moves to a position of indignation or anger at those that have given him advice. He says in verse 1, "How can you say to my soul to flee? How can you tell me that? How could that be the advice that you're giving me? To give up, to run away, to forsake his obligation?" And he can say that, not because that maybe that was for them the most practical advice. Maybe the people talking with David, they really thought, "David, the best thing for you to do is just get out of here. We're looking out for you. We want to protect you, David. Just run away." Their intentions may have been good, but David is seeing something much more powerful at work than simply his own life. He refuses to leave the throne to Saul or to Absalom, depending on the case. He refuses to abandon his God-given task, but says it's worth fighting for it. It's worth doing and trusting in God to deliver me and work things out for good. There will always be for us moments of doubt and fear. Accept it. There's always going to be things in our lives or in the state of the world that we do not understand and we question and we don't know how it's going to work out, but we have chosen to trust in God that He will do things in His time, in His way, to solve the evils of the world. And we continue to plug through, trusting in that picture of God. Trusting in God to do what is right. And sure, there are going to be lots of unanswered questions that we have to wrestle with. And we may think that the struggle isn't always worth it, that the pain is too great. But we persevere, not because we have all of the answers, but in the God that we have come to know and trust. And we seek our refuge in Him. And discouragement and fear may linger. It may prick at our hearts from time to time and cause us to have these moments of crisis. But we plug through because of God and our trust in Him. David then concludes his psalm here in the second half with his delight in the nature and character of God. Let's reread that in verse 4. So this is coming after the question, "What can the righteous do? The Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, His eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, His soul hates. Upon the wicked He will rain snares. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. The upright will behold His face." He starts by describing and delighting in what the Lord is doing. Notice where he puts God in the image geographically there in verse 4. Where is God? Where is the Lord? He is in His temple. That's not to say God is in that one spot and nowhere else. The image is lost in us in English or even in our culture with our lack of temples or a view of temples. In the ancient cultures, in the ancient Near East, the temple was seen as the place where, in the pagan world, the god ruled and exerted his control or influence. So it was like being at the controls, that if the god was in his temple, he was at the control room. He's in the control room doing things. And so David couples that. God, the Lord, is in his temple, he's at the controls, and he reigns on his throne. He's not absent from David. He is very much near and working. So he's dealing with this discouragement of this issue, but from a standpoint of knowing that God is in the temple, working and reigning, and that things are still in his hands, and he is bringing about the redemption of the world, and he's bringing about the salvation of David. He also describes God as far as what God is doing. He's in his temple reigning. He's in his temple or on his throne in control. But he's also sitting in judgment. And God can see what you and I cannot. He can see the heart, and he sees it crystal clear. He knows what's really going on with people, what their motivations are. So he stands in judgment. And he describes the things that God hates. You know, he tests the righteous and the wicked, but he hates the one who does violence. Now, for David, that's very much in his experience right now, being hunted down by Saul or Absalom, experiencing this type of violence. And he says that God hates violence. He hates the one who does violence, who seeks to destroy and kill. And he trusts in God as judge, that God is not absent. He's not blind. He sees what David is going through and will set it right. Will ultimately bring about his purpose. Now, we may be discouraged when we think about what we see on CNN or Fox News or MSNBC or whatever in the newspaper. We may feel discouraged because all we see around us is wickedness and violence and corruption. When we think about on a personal level in our relationships, people letting us down and people hurting us, or a lack of being able to fulfill the things that we believe God has called us to do, and we may want to give up, but the image of David, the image of Psalm 11 is God in his temple at work, and to trust in God that he will be victorious, that he will win, because he is in his temple and he is reigning. Now, he can say this, what the Lord is doing, because of who God is. Saying somebody is a king maybe doesn't conjure up very good images for us, because we think of kings maybe as a tyrant, a king who abuses his people or takes advantage of people, or a judge who is a corrupt judge, who plays favorites, who's not fair with the law. And so those images may not convey all of the power. That's why David attaches to them the character of God. So when God acts as judge or reigns as king, he does so from a position of his character. And the way he is described there in verse 7, that the Lord is righteous. That's who he is. When we think about righteousness, we might attach to that meanings of, somebody is righteous, then they are just morally perfect or morally good. So if you're a righteous person, you're a good moral person. Might be how we use that term. That did not convey all of the significance of the Jewish expression of righteousness. Because what the Jewish expression of righteousness would convey is being faithful to the covenant, faithful to the agreement. You were righteous in that you did what your part of the covenant said for you to do. So for David to say the Lord is righteous, and not only is righteous but loves righteousness, means God is faithful to his promises. God is faithful to the covenant that he made with David specifically and Israel in general to bring about righteousness and justice and this fulfillment of his plan. Now, David likely comes to that conclusion that the Lord is righteous and loves righteousness based upon Israel's history, based upon the Exodus, David's personal experiences with God, his ability to win victory and secure the borders of Israel. That may be what gets David to say that. I don't have that same level of experience. What gets me to say that the Lord is righteous and loves righteousness is Jesus of Nazareth. Because in Jesus, God ultimately, completely, and fully revealed his righteousness, his faithfulness to his covenant, his faithfulness to his pledge, going all the way back to Abraham, to redeem and to bless the world. And so I can look at Jesus and see, well, there is God's faithfulness. There is God who loves faithfulness. Then we can bring it down to the personal, to the micro. So I'm dealing with a situation that I don't understand. I don't have the answer. I don't know why this is happening. I don't know what good is going to come from this, if any good is going to come from this, if I'm ever going to see the good come from it. But I know through Jesus that God is righteous, that he has made promises to me that he will keep and never break, because he is righteous and loves righteousness, and so my faith in him is warranted. And I can say, like David in verse 1, in the Lord I take refuge, and I trust in him as the one who is righteous. One final note from the psalm. He delights in what the Lord will do in the future. Not only with who he is and what he's doing in the moment as the king that reigns, but also the promises about what is coming up. David has this deep conviction in Psalm 11 that God will vindicate him, that God will fulfill that promise, and that in the future things will be brought together and God will complete his purpose and his missions. David Well, and I'm not sure we could fully say this about David. All the promises to David don't get fulfilled in his lifetime. You know, and we talked about this in class on 2 Samuel 7, the promise about, you know, his descendants and reigning forever on the throne. David doesn't get to see all of those play out. So the promises we get from God about his justice and his love and his putting the world right, you and I may never see that in our lifetime. In fact, the very notion of resurrection, and I hate to bring it up because it's very, we could talk about it a long time, and maybe we can in the future. The notion of resurrection comes from, and originally gets its thought, and the Jews start to articulate it and come to terms with it, based from the exile. So you see it, you know, coming up in Daniel 12 and Ezekiel with the dry bones, that it comes from the exile, because what the Jews had to come to grips with in the exile is some of them weren't going to come back. Some of them weren't going to see God restore his people. So they had to think, well, if God is just and he's loving and he's faithful to his covenant, how is all of that going to work out? And so the image and the language of the resurrection began to get used as a way of saying God will fulfill his covenant and fulfill his promises and we will be raised from the dead. So am I dealing with discouragement or you're dealing with discouragement? We may not see in our lifetime the answer, and see God's exercising of his righteousness. But we know in the resurrection, all of his promises will be fulfilled and complete, and we will experience them and see them and be in the presence of God forever. That's the justice of God. That's his faithfulness. And David takes comfort in that. And it doesn't mean for David, for him to say, you know, in verse 7, that the upright will behold his face and to have this trust in God's justice. Doesn't mean that David has somehow been given by God this point by point of the future. Okay, David, tomorrow this is what's going to happen all the way through the rest of your life. So you've got all your questions answered. Don't worry, don't doubt, don't fear. David still has to go, well, what's going to happen tomorrow? But he is entering into that fog with the knowledge of God and his promises and trusting in God's actions in the future. So maybe you and I can't see what tomorrow will bring or what's going to happen the rest of our lives. We may have lots of questions and doubts and fears and feel discouraged by them. But it's not our job to work out exactly what each day is going to bring and to have some blueprint of the future. Our job is to know God, to be faithful to our end of the covenant and to serve him and follow him and trust in him as the one who vindicates, who brings justice and love. So David deals with this difficult time on the run, his promises brought into doubt and jeopardy, but trusting in God because of his identity and because of his actions. And you and I need to cling to these things as well, even when we have unanswered questions and fears. Said in the beginning that discouragement is not very hard to find, whether it's collective discouragement about the future conditions of the world or the country or personal discouragement or fears about our own lives and relationships. It's not very hard to have those things creep up and take over, to allow just a wave of discouragement to say, it's not worth it, it's not going to happen, nothing good can come from this. But like David, we cling to this notion of God as the one who loves, who exercises justice and righteousness, and we know that by Jesus. As God revealed and executed his righteousness through Jesus. And so if you're here this evening, and that discouragement is winning, and we've probably all been there at some point where the discouragement is getting more shots than we're giving back to it. But God never meant for his people to be in isolation, to suffer those things alone. He put us together and he knit us as a temple where the presence of God dwells and we comfort and we support and we help each other push on. And we give the advice that David needed to hear in Psalm 11 about the nature and character of God, and we support each other going forward. And so if you find yourself in need of that type of comfort and help, to pray that God will comfort you, will give you guidance, and for us to help and build you up. That is why we are here, and that is why we are the people of God, to support each other. And if you need to come forward, we invite you now as we stand and sing.